Thank you for downloading this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. CFR is an independent national membership organization and nonpartisan research center. For more information, please visit us online at cfr.org.
Good afternoon from New York, and welcome to the CFR Academic Conference Call Series. I'm Irina Faskanis, Vice President for the National Program and Outreach here at CFR. Today's call is on the record, and the audio will be available on our website, www.cfr.org, if you would like to share it with colleagues or classmates. We're delighted to have Shannon O'Neill with us today to talk about U.S.-Mexico relations. Dr. O'Neill is CFR's Senior Fellow for Latin America Studies. She is the author of a new book, Two Nations Indivisible, Mexico, the United States, and the Road Ahead. And this book was just released this week, and today's call is the first the unveiling of it, so we're very excited to have her talking about it. Dr. O'Neill directed CFR's Independent Task Force on U.S.-Latin America Relations, A New Direction for a New Reality. She's testified before Congress on U.S. policy toward Mexico and Latin America more broadly, and is a frequent commentator on major television and radio programs. She writes the CFR blog, Latin America's Moment, and she tweets at Shannon K. O'Neill, so I hope that you will tune into her blog and follow her on Twitter. Shannon, thanks very much for being with us today. It would be great if you could talk a little bit about the major themes in your book, Mexico's political, economic, and social transformations, and what it means for the U.S.
Great. Well, thank you, Irina. Good afternoon to everyone. Let me start talking about, to frame it, talking about a trip I took a few months ago to Ciudad Juarez for a week. And as many of you probably know, Juarez is right along the border, the Texas border, just across from El Paso. And during that time there, one of the days during this week, I spent with the father of a straight-A student, of a football player, who was unfortunately murdered with 14 of his friends and teammates as they were celebrating a championship. And what had happened is they were mistaken for a rival gang by some gang hitmen. And unfortunately, this has not been an isolated case in the city. And Ciudad Juarez in recent years has grown to be what some would say the murder capital of the world, especially back a couple of years. It was, by some rankings, the most dangerous place in the world. Now, this day, he picked me up at the border, and we drove about half an hour to the neighborhood where it happened. He wanted to show me the house, but he also wanted to show me a park down the road that he and his wife have invested all of their energies in to make life better for those kids that still live there. And what struck me on this day was, one, his personal resilience in the face of tragedy. But the other thing that stood out for me was the road there. And so from the border during this half-hour trip, we passed factory after factory after factory. And there were internationally known brands, there were domestic brands, there were things from flat-screen TVs to wind turbines to automotive parts to beer and processed foods and all sorts of other types of different commodities, different types of manufactured goods. And these were huge, bustling facilities. And the next day, I met with a reporter and an editor of one of the local papers, and he told me that even when the violence hit its height in Juarez, not one of these factories left, and since things have started to get better, more and more have come in. And it's this juxtaposition that I saw in Juarez that is, one, the gravest of threats in terms of security, but also these great possibilities and economic possibilities. I would say it's this juxtaposition that defines, in many ways, Mexico today. And so if you open any newspaper, you will get this drug story. And it is a real and quite serious story. You look back under the last presidency, the last 6 years, and over 70,000 people have been killed, probably another 20 or 30,000 disappeared. No one knows what happened to them. And crime overall, if you add in robberies and kidnappings and extortion and the like, it's one of the worst in the hemisphere. So this is an incredibly real story. But it's not the only story in Mexico today. And overlooked in Mexico, I would say, are many other changes that have happened, many of them for the positive. Some are in politics, a move from a one-party political system to now what is a competitive democracy. And another big area of change has been Mexico's economy. And so let me talk a little bit about and flesh that out, the big changes that we've seen on the economic side in Mexico. One of these big changes over the last 30 years has been the real structure, the basic structure of Mexico's economy. So in the 1980s, if you looked at its economy, it was quite closed off to the United States and to the world in general. Mexico's economy hid behind high tariffs, many quotas, many subsidies, and hundreds of state-owned enterprises. When you looked at what Mexico exported, it wasn't all that much, and really what it was oil that came north. Fast forward to today, and Mexico is one of the most open economies in the world. It has free trade agreements with over 40 nations. And it's now actually an export-led manufacturing powerhouse. So the vast majority of its exports are manufactured, and it's increasingly competitive in a global world. So it's made this transition from a commodity and agricultural-based economy to a manufacturing and services one, one that many emerging markets are still just trying and beginning to do. Another big shift we've seen in the last 30 years is changes in consumption. And here, Mexico has moved from a poor nation to a middle-class one. So while traditionally a place of a very few haves and many, many have-nots, today, by most measures, a slim majority, or some 60 million Mexicans, can be considered middle-class. So that means they have increased disposable income. Over half of them own their own cars. Almost everybody has a cell phone. A third have a computer. Many families have their own homes. And this is a real transformation over the last couple decades. And it's also begun driving economic growth. So consumption has become a big part of annual GDP growth figures in a way that it really wasn't in the past. So it's in some ways privatizing economic development. And then a final big economic change, I would say, which leads us to the United States, is the economic ties to the U.S. And you look today, and because of NAFTA, because of economic openings, because of a whole host of reasons, trade between the United States and Mexico has now topped $500 billion worth each year, so over $500 billion. Now, Mexico and the United States have always been linked economically because of the border and the like. But what has changed is not just the amount of trade, but actually what the composition of this trade. So where once it was mostly oil coming north and final products going south, today what goes back and forth really are pieces and parts. As Mexico has become part of a North American supply chain or sort of a platform. And in fact, an interesting statistic here is for all those goods that are imported from Mexico to the United States, i.e. all the ones we think of as quote-unquote made in Mexico, on average, 40% of those products were actually made in the United States. And this compares to, say, less than 4% from China or Brazil or places like that. So this means that it's the back and forth of production is something that really stands out and is unique, even to a greater extent than, say, Canada, which is also part of this platform. With Mexico, it's almost unique, the amount of back and forth that occurs. And it's this back and forth that has allowed places like Ciudad Juarez on an economic side to explode, even as they're facing an incredible security problem. But it's also a back and forth that has helped U.S. companies thrive and grow and support workers in both nations. And estimates today show that this trade with Mexico supports somewhere in the range of 6 million U.S. jobs today. So as we look at Mexico and U.S.-Mexico relations today, we have two relatively new administrations, the second Obama administration starting up and the Peña Nieto administration that started just last December. Now, they have on their agenda, they have security, obviously, because that's an ongoing concern for both nations. But the challenge will be to move beyond this as a priority and to move particularly beyond this as a perception. There's so many other issues on the agenda between the two countries. And to really benefit from them, Mexico needs to be positioned in the United States more as a partner of our country rather than just a problem. And Mexico should be a partner for enhancing our own economic competitiveness and export orientation, things that Obama and others have talked about in the last several years as we try to increase growth and come out of a recession. Mexico should be a partner for the many issues that arise because of the shared border, not just security, but there are issues of water, of the environment, of infrastructure, and the like. And Mexico can be a good and easy partner in many of the larger global issues that we face today in multilateral organizations, whether it's world financial architecture or climate change or other issues that really need a multilateral forum to resolve them. So as we go forward, the challenge here in the United States is going to be to see and accept Mexico's new realities, both the good, some of the economic and political and social changes that have happened, but also the bad, and particularly the deterioration in security that we've seen there. And this will be a serious challenge for the United States because arguably, I would say Mexico is probably the most overlooked foreign policy challenge we have today. So with that, let me turn it back to you and to questions.
Terrific. Thanks so much, Shannon. Let's open it up to the group, Katie, and we want to give students first priority.
Yes, ma'am. At this time, we will open the floor for questions. If you would like to ask a question, please press the star key, followed by the one key on your touchtone phone now. Questions will be taken in the order in which they are received. If at any time you would like to remove yourself from the questioning queue, please press star two. Again, that is star one for all questions. Our first comes from St. Edward's University.
Good morning. My name is Vance Roper, and I had a question in reference to your comment a little earlier about Mexico and the middle class and the amount of people in the middle class in Mexico. What figures are we using to determine what's considered middle class in Mexico as far as salary or income range?
Sure. So, you know, there are a lot of different ways of thinking about the middle class and different ways of measuring it. So you look at the World Bank, and they throw everybody who earns more than $2 a day up there. And there, it puts the middle class as 90-95% of Mexicans. And, you know, for us in the United States or other OECD-type countries, the idea of you being in the middle class if you earned over $2, it doesn't ring true, $2 a day. The OECD has other measures. They place Mexico's middle class, again, much higher if you combine the Mexican and the middle and then, say, upper class, probably 80 or 90 million people in Mexico, maybe 70% of the population. You look at Coneval, which are the Mexican government statistics, their agency, they have a very holistic view of poverty and middle class, upper class. They include things like access to health care, other social services, and the like. They place about 45, perhaps up to 48%, of Mexicans in as poor or as vulnerable to poverty in some cases, which leaves there another 55-plus percent who are not, i.e. who would be considered more middle and upper class. You know, when I've done some of these analysis and statistics and you look at sort of purchasing power parity and all that sort of thing, there's another interesting way of measuring the global middle class, which is to take the OECD countries and take out the wealthiest, Luxembourg and those, and then take out the poorest, take the poverty line in the poorest, the Portugals and Italy's, and measure sort of those middle above the poverty line in the poorest of the, say, mature economies and below the upper income line of the wealthiest. And there you get a range of somewhere between $7,000 and $85,000 a year for per person, often. When you think about the middle class, you're also talking about households where two people, you may have a dual income family, and so the amount is a bit more, actually, that the household has to spend. And it's that sort of measure. So above the poverty line in say, Italy, Portugal, the sort of lower end of the OECD, that would define the middle class. And that's where you come up with this number of about 60 million plus Mexicans.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Next question, please.
Again, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star one at this time. Our next question comes from Bush School of Government and Public Safety.
Good morning. I was wondering, how do you foresee Mexico responding to rising production costs in China?
We've seen over the last couple years, particularly labor costs, rise from China, you know, anywhere between, you know, 15-30% a year, depending on industries and where you are. I mean, the other big challenge for China with some products and which benefits Mexico as well is transportation costs. So as rising oil prices, as oil prices rise, so too do the costs of shipping particularly heavy things across the Pacific Ocean. The other costs that benefit Mexico, say, vis-a-vis China, for many companies are, one, just-in-time delivery costs. So many industries, they like to have inventory at, you know, 6, 8, or day truck ride away rather than a, you know, couple-week boat ride away. And then finally, the other issue in sort of this calculation of competitiveness of production is the issue, a real issue, particularly with China, of intellectual property rights. And there, most all would say that Mexico and other countries, but Mexico in particular, because of NAFTA and the terms within NAFTA, is much more open to the protection and paths for protecting your intellectual property than places like China. So putting this all together, labor obviously is an important part, but I think all of these elements are important in people deciding where you might locate a new factory or where you might put production. Over the last couple of years, as many of these costs have risen or become more apparent for China and the benefits of Mexico have increased in many of these areas, we've seen some real investment, foreign direct investment in Mexico. One of the biggest has been in the car, in the automotive industry. And there you see both the labor side, but you see particularly the transportation costs being a big deal because cars are heavy. So we see a movement there. I mean, one of the issues where China still dominates or is quite favorable to China vis-a-vis Mexico is that China is integrated through Asia in these Asian supply chains, so international supply chains. So if you want to get your iPhone made, not only can they make the iPhone, but they have the glass, they have the other things in nearby countries or parts of China. And so it's hard to move one factory when you need sort of this larger production chain. So as Mexico goes forward and thinks about competing with China, which it is doing successfully in some areas, there are these other challenges. And then finally, the other challenge for Mexico vis-a-vis China is the security issue, which, you know, as I mentioned, is a quite serious one. And anyone who's thinking about investing hundreds of millions of dollars in Mexico obviously grapples with this issue. Many will still decide to go ahead and do it, but it obviously is a challenge.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Florida A&M.
Hello. I want to know, what are some of your suggestions for America's foreign policy towards Mexico to build more of a partnership that you think of with Mexico while avoiding a lot of the corruption that is within the Mexican?
Sure. So in terms of how we could work better with Mexico, I think there are a few different areas. I mean, one is obviously on the economic side and how we can facilitate the flows that are important for companies, and not just companies on both sides of the border, but also workers. Because Mexico, Canada, there's a few other countries, but there really is, we often think about if jobs go to Mexico, it's a zero-sum game, and it takes away jobs from people in the United States. But what we've actually found and what studies show is often that when you invest abroad in places like Mexico, and particularly Mexico, given this integration of producing, of making things, a couple jobs created there actually create jobs back here. So it is actually one of these cases of win-win on both sides of the border. So as we think about working with Mexico, a big way to start is to make it easier to get, to have trade, to have these goods flow over the border. And as we've seen this exponential growth in recent years of trade, we have not seen a complementary, much less exponential growth in infrastructure at the border. So today, our infrastructure is overwhelmed. Much of it is decrepit. We've had cases in the last couple of years of ports of entry, of sort of the actual infrastructure falling down and hitting cars. But we also just have, it's too limited. There's too few lanes. There's too few people working there. And there hasn't been, in many places, the technological upgrade that would allow these things to happen more quickly and make it easier for manufacturers on both sides of the border to compete. So there's an upgrade infrastructure. We could talk about standardizing customs reforms and other types of standards that we have for the types of products, EPA number standards. And this is all, you know, it's not that exciting. It's not signing a new trade agreement. But these types of changes would make a huge difference for companies that every time they send something across the border have to fill out multiple paperwork and other types of forms. These are important. Now, how do we deal with corruption in Mexico? Well, it's a hard thing to deal with. There are, on the big macro side of it, Mexico is right now reforming its justice system. A new system is supposed to be implemented by 2016, so in 3 years, and that's something to watch in terms of this new presidency, both on the security side, which if it goes into place and there's a lot of political will behind it, should help improve the security side. But it's also important for the economy and for the corruption that you bring up there. You know, will Mexico, either in the current system or under the new system, will it actually go after high-profile cases and prosecute and convict government officials or others who are engaging in corruption? I mean, I think that is a big challenge and something to watch. The other side of things is on the U.S. side, and right now actually working its way through the U.S. Department of Justice is the Walmart case. And I don't know if any of you have been reading in the last 6 months or year, there's been a couple New York Times articles and others uncovering some malfeasance, it looks like alleged malfeasance, by Walmart in the way they placed stores and the way they got permits to build stores in Mexico. So I think it's not just the Mexican courts that might need to do their work, but there could be a space, which our Justice Department is now investigating under the corporate the FIFA, the laws that you're not allowed to bribe people, so I can't remember the name, bribe people abroad and the types of practices you're allowed to do. And so if our companies stick to standard international practices and clean practices, I think that also can help Mexico's system strengthen and give other companies, Mexican companies as well, the gumption to stand down or to deny those who might ask them for bribes and continue this corruption.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Richard Stockton College.
Hi. I was wondering if you could talk more about the war on drugs and how it affects our relations with Mexico.
Sure. So it's an interesting balance. Up until perhaps 6 years ago, the United States and Mexico had very little security cooperation and assistance, very little back and forth. Under President Bush, as well as President Calderon, they started a program called the Merida Initiative, which really increased both the amount of money, almost tenfold, but also the day-to-day back and forth, starting to build trust between different law enforcement institutions, between our militaries, between our prosecuting attorneys, Department of Justices, and the like. So we've seen, actually, over the last 5 or 6 years, a real flowering of what was once almost nothing to a quite deep security cooperation on many different levels, federal, state, and a little bit local. So in some ways, the war on drugs and the heating up of it in Mexico has brought the two nations closer together on security cooperation. But it's also been a bit of a double-edged sword, because as Mexico's violence has escalated over the last several years, the causes of it, or some of the causes of it, the drugs, the guns, the demand, the money from the United States, obviously are very difficult and have increased tensions. And we particularly saw under Calderon in the last couple of years his incredible frustration with the United States and its inability to stop guns from flowing south, as well as the money back to the drug cartels. So this war on drugs mentality or focus of the last administration in particular brought both closer cooperation than we've ever had, as well as you know, out there often quite vocal frustration and tension in the relationship.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Minnesota State University.
My question pertains to the recent immigration news in the United States. So my question is, what are some measures that Mexico is taking in keeping their people in Mexico as opposed to leaving? And also, should the United States aid in that? Or should we make a path to become a citizen here?
Well, Mexico, as part of its constitution and the way it interprets it, does not hinder people from leaving the nation. They have the right as citizens to leave the country. So the sort of short answer is Mexico does very little to stop immigrants from leaving their country. So I think the big challenge here for the United States is to decide how to fix our immigration system in a way that brings it in line with the economic supply and demand that we see, and also brings it in line with some of our more humanitarian values. And the way that pertains to Mexico is through a couple ways. One issue is we usually think of, and you heard in the last presidential campaign, this idea that, you know, if we make it hard enough for the people who are trying to work here, the assumption that people are coming here illegally because they want to work, if we make it hard enough so they can't work here anymore, they'll self-deport. They'll go back home. And the real challenge is this sort of misunderstands those 11 million people who are here without papers, who are illegal or who are undocumented, of which probably 6-7 million are Mexican. The other 4 or 5 million are from other countries all around the world. And what evidence shows, what statistics shows, is they're not here just to work. Many of them did come originally to work, but you know, there's probably 4 or 5 million of those people who are here because of family ties now. So they have kids who are U.S. citizens, or their siblings are U.S. citizens, but they're not. Or their wife or their husband is a U.S. citizen, but they are not. And so these people, even if you make it impossible for them to work, they may not leave because they would never see their children again or not see their children again for 10 years. So this is also, and, you know, we get to questions of, would you like to deprive U.S. citizen kids of their parents so that they, you know, they're left as orphans at 5 or 6 years old because their parents are sent back to their countries, Mexico or others? So I think there's this real challenge in the United States to recognize that it's not just about economics, though it is large. Their economics are vital and important, but it's not just about economics anymore. It's about families and about citizens and about communities and how to make it possible for them to stay in a legal way, but also make it fair to those that would come in through legal channels. And finally, to make those legal channels wide enough or open enough and flexible enough to, one, deal with labor, supply and demand, but also provide an avenue here for those that couldn't come otherwise. And there's lots of talk about people getting to the, you should go to the back of the line. And unfortunately for Mexicans, of which there are many here and many ties, while there's jobs here if they come here, there's actually no line for them to get into unless you have a close relative that can put you in that line. And even then, it might take you 15 or 20 years to get here. So you're asking parents, say, who has a 5-year-old living in Mexico, do I bring them illegally here now, or do I wait until they're 18 years old because that's how long it's going to take for them to come through legal channels? I mean, this is a heart-wrenching decision that parents make, and it is part of the reason why we do have a quite large illegal population.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from St. Norbert College.
Hi, my name is Amanda Garcia, and I would like to thank you for your speech, first of all. We see that U.S. foreign policy is sort of it's sort of focused on the Middle East, and what is it going to take for the U.S. foreign policy to focus back on Mexico and Latin America? Will it take a crisis?
That's the big question. I used to have a friend who would joke that the best thing that would happen for Latin America in order to get U.S. attention is if Hezbollah moved into Argentina. I'm not sure that's what we want. And part of the letting focus elsewhere is in some part because things are going well in this hemisphere. This is not a hemisphere that is overrun by civil wars. It's not a hemisphere overrun by terrorists. It's a nuclear-free zone, and so many of the worries and the reactive policy that we see in other parts of the world don't apply here. So in some ways, it's a good thing. It's because this hemisphere is doing well. But it also, it means issues that matter and can make the lives better for citizens in all of the countries, the United States included, often get pushed to the second, third page down the priority list and not addressed. So the immediate supersedes the longer term, but quite important. So what do we do? Well, for Mexico in particular, I would say, as I said, it's this big overlooked foreign policy challenge. But because of how important it is to the United States and how integrated it is through the economy, through people, through communities, through the environment, through all sorts of other issues, through security, it will, what is important or what should be important and what we should strive for is to have as domestic decisions are made, because so many things hinge on what U.S. policymakers think about is domestic decisions. So immigration is a domestic decision. Food policy is a domestic decision. And the environment is a domestic decision. Even our economic stimulus and the way we're going to regulate different types of products, we all see that as a domestic decision. So the challenge and something that we should push for is to, in making that domestic decision, which it will remain, also understand and incorporate a bit, seeing how it will affect countries like Mexico, which sort of straddle this line of foreign policy and pure domestic policy. So Mexico is never a country where our policy is going to be run out of the State Department because it's just too important for Treasury, for Commerce, for Department of Homeland Security, for defense, and for the EPA, for so many other areas. It's too important to be handled just by the State Department. It's too diverse and complicated. But we do want to make sure that State Department voice, the fact that these are countries working with each other, is brought into the mix. And I think that's the big challenge.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from St. Edward's University.
Yes, ma'am. You mentioned earlier about when you were in Juarez, you've seen many businesses that are still in Mexico, many more coming into Mexico. I'm curious if you've heard anybody speak of or seen anything about those businesses participating and helping in the community, or are they just down there more to make money and profits?
You know, Juarez is in some ways this example of, to me, of where Mexico is and the depths of where Mexico can go, particularly in terms of security, but also sort of the possibility of a much better future. And in part is just the presence of those factories that I mentioned in my opening remarks. But in part is also what the local business community has been doing. And when I was down there, I also spoke with many members, people who own some of those factories, but also some who have come together, most of them Mexicans, rather than, say, some of the multinationals, though they work with multinationals, but Mexican businessmen and women who have come together and decided that they needed to lean on their local government and also lean on the federal government to make Juarez a better place. So they truly formed civil society groups that have gone out into communities that have started to lobby and started to try to change things in the city that they live in and that they care about and that they operate in and make money off of. So I do think there is this incipient civil society movement that's come out of perhaps desperation in some cases, but it has spurred this, and it has spurred this movement, and they have become more and more involved, not just at the local stage, but also on the federal government stage in making demands and trying to change things. Now, this isn't every business, of course, and it is my experience there was that it was much more locals, people from Juarez or who Mexicans who had come to live in Juarez and work and have factories there than, say, the Foxconns or others that are there. But they also have contact with these people. So, you know, it's something to watch is does this really take off and thrive? But I have seen both sides of that, sort of this hopeful side and this resilience from and participation from this local business community.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you again. If you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1 at this time. Our next question comes from George Mason University.
Hi, my name is Jeffrey Beck. You spoke earlier about security concerns in Mexico and President Calderon, you know, using primarily the military, which actually increased violence. I was wondering if you could speak more to what the current administration's planning on doing, especially in the form of a new national police force that he talked about previously.
Yeah. Calderon brought out the military, in part because the police force, in his view, and probably justified, was unreliable and unable to do what he felt needed to be done. And while bringing up the military, he worked hard to build up a federal police force to some 35, 40,000 strong that was, you know, by all accounts, more vetted, more professional, more trained, though they did also, in some instances, have issues and worries about penetration and corruption as well, like many forces down there. I mean, the challenge now for the Peña Nieto government is how will they continue on the security side? It was quite important in the campaigns. You look at polls, and voters care about the economy and security. Those are the two big things. So it's important for him and his government as they go forward. And for the PRI in general, who would like to win the midterm and the next presidential election, they have to do something on security. And so in these first few months, he's come out with some big pronouncements. He's talked about forming a new gendarmerie, another sort of national police force. His cabinet ministers have been quite contradictory so far in what this will mean. Is it going to be a sort of federal SWAT team that will come into places with lots of turmoil, or is it going to be a rural, sort of open, going into open spaces, police force along the lines of the Italian similar type of force? It's a little bit unclear. It's also unclear if they're going to have the budget that would be necessary to build up a real force. So I would say at this point, while this government has been moving quite quickly on economic issues and reforms, we've seen many come down the pike already through Congress or being negotiated there right now, the security side has been lagging a little bit in terms of what their real plans are. They've been vague in many ways. They've talked about shifting from focusing on purely sort of drug trafficking interdiction to dealing with crime overall. Many of the policies for either of those strategies are the same. If you want to catch drug dealers or you want to stop car thieves and kidnappers and extorters, what you need are professional police forces and court systems that work. Both of those will help deal with all, you know, basic crimes, all types of crimes, or deal directly with drug trafficking. But there's other policies that can be different, and it's where you put your resources. Do you go after particular kingpins broadly, or do you focus more on the local, you know, robbing rings or kidnapping organizations? And that, I think, is where we may see a shift with this government, is a little bit more of a focus on local crime in terms of where you dedicate resources. But I don't see the military coming out of the streets or of cities anytime soon, and the government said that just because there's nothing to go in behind them yet. And I do see this push towards professionalizing police forces, particularly now at the state and local level, pushing for the court reforms, the justice reforms that are sort of in process, continuing that. I think those will continue, sort of a following on the last administration, because they are what voters want.
Thank you. Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from University of Minnesota.
Hi there. And you kind of touched on this a little bit before when you mentioned Movement for Civil Society, but I was curious if you could talk about the political consequences of the larger middle class in Mexico. Is the fact that that there's maybe a broader economic growth going to, might we finally see democracy or a more open government that is reliable as opposed to the one-party dominance that happened for most of the 20th century?
What's interesting in Mexico is as this middle class grew, we saw in public opinion polls more and more Mexicans, when asked, identify themselves as independents, i.e. more and more people left when they were asked. They didn't say they were from the PRI or the PAN or the PRD. They just said they were independent. We've also seen in some of the more recent elections over the last 10, 15 years, more of split ticket voting, i.e. you vote for one party for the presidency, but for your senator or your representative, you vote for a different party. So we see this in the United States, and you started seeing more of it in Mexico. For, as you point out, for many, many years, just everybody voted for the PRI, whether they, you know, wanted to or not, or, you know, they were encouraged to by their unions or by their local organizations or by, you know, local party bosses. So the rise of the middle class has also been a big part of this growing independence. And they, you know, many scholars would say, many that watch, analyze elections would say that they were the deciding factor shifting away from the PRI to vote for Vicente Fox in 2000 to bring an opposition party into the Los Pinos, Mexico's White House. And then they were also very important in Calderón becoming elected for president. And the swing away from López Obrador was precisely this middle class. For Peña Nieto, too, this last time, many of them went with him, and so he came in as well. I do see in Mexico a pretty robust democratic system today. Yes, it has problems. There are areas that are not transparent, that are not opaque. There's worries about information and even money flows and the like. But what we have, particularly compared to, say, 20-plus years ago, is we have competitive elections. We have a legislature that is vital for passage of every bill. So presidents can't hand down dictates. And the legislature, since it's divided, no party has a majority. It always means a negotiation between at least two parties, if not all three parties. Right now, Mexico has been negotiating between all three parties with this pact that's been formed, but any legislation would need at least another party signed on if it was going to pass. And we've also seen over the last 15, 20 years a strengthening and growing autonomy from at least the Supreme Court in Mexico, which has been vital and some decisions has really made a difference in terms of checking both other politicians and political parties, but vested interests in Mexico. So, you know, whatever the tenor of Peña Nieto, of the PRI that's come back, whether it's old or new or unchanged or transformed or who's what, I do think there's a robustness to Mexico's political institutions and checks and balances there that will continue in a democratic form.
Thank you. Next question, please.
Again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 at any time. Our next question comes from the University of Puget Sound.
What kind of strategies can be used to help professionalize local police forces?
I mean, this is the first thing. It has to come from Mexico. They have to want to do that. But there's lots of things they can do, and also the things that the United States can help with. Some of them are pretty basic. There are things like, you know, in Mexico, if you went to a local police force today, there are very few of the almost 2,000 different municipal police forces. There's very few that actually have a manual to tell police officers what to do. So, you know, what does a police officer do when they pull you over for speeding? They don't know. They don't have rules. Now, there's a question about whether they would follow those rules or not, but they don't even have a set manual, set standards of, you know, activity, of action, of what they do. And that's something we have in the United States. If you're a police officer, you go through training, and not only do you learn how to, you know, hold a gun and collect evidence and the like, but you also learn what to do in regular situations like that. And Mexico doesn't have that yet. They don't have standardization at all for police forces. And in the United States, we have different standards. One's called CALEA. It comes out of California. Others come out of other places. But it's certification for police departments that they have these things, like these standards. They have particular types of training. They have different systems and certifications. And that's something that Mexican police forces, that would be a vital step towards professionalizing, particularly local police forces. I mean, that's an important part of it. The other part that's quite important is just basic resources for equipment. In Mexico, often local police officers are having to buy their own gasoline for patrol cars. They have to buy their own bullets for their guns, and they're paid a pittance. So those that would go into a career where they won't get paid very much, where they will have to, you know, buy much of their own equipment, you sort of wonder why you would go into that career if you had any other opportunities. So that's another challenge in terms of professionalizing police forces. And then a final one, which is more on an institutional and legislative level, is setting up watchdog institutions or checks and balances within the police forces. And you look at the history of the United States or Italy or other types of places, we have had our own struggles in the United States with corrupt police forces and the like. I don't know if any of you ever saw the movie L.A. Confidential or Serpico long ago. And, you know, these were about corrupt police forces. And the way we in the United States dealt with them was through internal affairs, commissions within police forces that would investigate others and then prosecute them if they found malfeasance, they found wrongdoing. We also set up what are called RICO laws, racketeering laws, that allowed prosecutors to try people not just caught in the act of drug trafficking or other types of crimes, but for being part of a quote-unquote conspiracy. So you could go after a larger organization in organized crime. And those sorts of things would help indirectly clean up police forces because there would be a cost to corruption, which today, unfortunately, in Mexico and in many places, there really isn't.
Next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the Bush School of Government and Public Service.
Hi. My question had to do about the future role of Mexico's state oil company Pemex in the national economy, and basically with low U.S. natural gas prices and declining production from the current Pemex fields, where does that leave the company in the future? Is there going to be a move towards privatization of some parts of it, or is it going to stay state-owned?
So the Peña Nieto government, during the campaign and even in recent months since he's come into office, has talked about reforming the energy sector in Mexico. Most people themselves and others who have talked about it, what would change? They talked about trying to push a constitutional reform, but one that would really deal with new projects as opposed to older projects, the fields that are already in production. And many of the new potential oil and gas finds in Mexico are ones that require fairly sophisticated expertise and equipment and a lot of investment. So whether it's deep water drilling in the Gulf of Mexico or it's shale gas and tight oil in various parts of Mexico, these are going to require an expertise and equipment that Pemex does not have as of now, and that would be very costly for Pemex to adopt. So these are areas where, you know, people talk about joint risk sharing or joint ventures being allowed. I don't see Pemex itself being privatized. Is it going to be Petrobras style, a Brazilian state-owned oil and energy company that, you know, ended up being cleaned up, transformed, and then listed on the stock market? Though it's still controlled by the government, there's part of it that is listed on the stock market and can be invested in. I don't see Pemex following that, at least not under this administration at this time. But I do see a need for, given the falls in production that you mentioned and changes in worldwide energy markets, the need for, if Mexico wants to continue to keep its production at a stable rate, much less increase it, there's going to be a huge need for outside investment and expertise. And the way to attract other big oil companies, whether they're also state-owned companies like Petrobras or others from around the world, or private companies like the ExxonMobils or Chevrons and what have you, you are going to have to offer them some sort of joint venture, and that's what I expect a reform to look like.
Thank you. Next question.
Again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 at any time. Our next question comes from the Florida A&M University.
Hi. I was interested in knowing what role is education, more specifically higher education, playing in strengthening the middle class, bringing more people into the middle class, helping to solve national issues, I guess ultimately making it more attractive for people wanting to stay in the country and less attractive for them to want to get involved in the drug trade.
I mean, this has been a big change, too. Mexicans on average over the last 15-plus years have increased the numbers of years on average they stay in school by 2 or 3 years, which it may not sound like that much, but it is a big change. So, and especially it means some are not only just getting through primary school, but they're getting through secondary school, and many of those are going on to college. We've seen the building and expansion of many universities in Mexico, and the numbers of particularly those graduating in the sort of STEM occupations, right, the engineers and technicians and the like, you know, have increased into the tens of thousands. So there has been a big increase and push for higher education. And partly it's this middle class. It's middle class has more disposable income, and many of them, and they also are having many fewer kids than, say, their parents had. You look at Mexican demographics in the late 70s, early 80s, the average family had 7 kids. Today they have just over 2. So with more income and fewer kids, you have more money to spend on education, or at least fairly spend it on education. And so you see kids staying in school longer. You also see the rise of not just private universities, but private primary and secondary schools, and not just for the wealthy, but for this new middle or even the sort of upper working class. You're seeing more and more private schools. In part, that is this investment that they're making in their kids. In part, unfortunately, it's because the public school system in Mexico is quite bad. And it has been dominated by the teachers' union for many, many years, which has often defended the rights of teachers over perhaps the rights of students. A big move we saw in Mexico just over a month ago is that the Peña Nieto government, after negotiating an education reform and fighting strongly with the leader of the education teachers' union, brought charges against her for fraud and embezzlement. Now, this is a woman who's been incredibly powerful for over 20 years, and she's known for wearing incredibly expensive clothes on her teacher salary of $80,000 or $90,000 a year, outfits that cost more than that. But no government had ever investigated or dared to bring charges against her, and they have. So this is one of sort of the big vested interests in Mexico, and at least as it goes forward now, she's being charged with stealing millions of dollars from her union. So many see this as a sign that they're serious about changing the education structure, but it is a big challenge. And for the growing middle class, for a growing and for the economy to take off, particularly as, you know, we move into global worlds and as technology and everything increases, you need to be better educated, better trained to compete in a global world. And for things like immigration, which is obviously also important for Mexico and for the United States, you want people to stay there. You want people, especially educated people, to stay and use their talents and their skills in Mexico to make it a better place rather than taking those talents and skills to the United States and starting their companies here where, you know, it benefits America more than it benefits Mexico. I mean, these are all challenges. But I would say many steps have moved in a better direction over the last 10, 15 years, but there's still much to do. And Mexico, if it can't fix its education system, will be held back.
Shannon, it would be terrific if you could summarize any final thoughts on the way forward for U.S.-Mexico relations, given the challenges and opportunities you outlined.
Sure. Well, it's been a pleasure to speak with all of you today. I hope it's been interesting for you, and if you want to learn more about how I think about these things, you should check out my book, Two Nations Indivisible. But really where this book looks, looking at these big transformations in Mexico. And Mexico has gone from a closed economy to one of the most open in the world and one dominated by manufacturing. It's gone from a one-party authoritarian political regime to a competitive democracy. It's gone from a country of have and have-nots to a majority middle-class nation. And it's also gone from one, those are the good things, but the bad thing is it's gone from one of deteriorating security and now incredible violence through organized crime. And so as the United States goes forward and works with this country, which is ever more tied to ours through economics, through people, through environment, through the border, we need to understand all of these realities, both the good parts and the bad, and find ways to work together at the national level, but also at the federal and local. And also not just government officials, but companies, people, churches, all these different types of organizations. And if we can do it, it'll be better for everybody on both sides of the border.
Shannon, thank you again for today and for everybody's terrific questions. I hope that you will all take a look at Shannon's book, Two Nations Indivisible, as well as following her blog post, Latin America's Moment, and signing up to follow her on Twitter. Again, it's Shannon K. O'Neill. So we appreciate it and look forward to reading more of your analysis, Shannon. Our next call will take place on Wednesday, April 10th at 12 p.m. Eastern Time. Isabel Coleman, CFR Senior Fellow and Director of the Civil Markets and Democracy Initiative, will discuss economic and democratic transitions. We also, our academic initiative is on Twitter, so you can follow us at CFR_academic for information on new resources such as Shannon's books and other things, as well as upcoming events. And the final thing is I hope that you all consider submitting a question. We have a new feature up and running where we are showcasing questions from students that will be answered by our experts, Shannon O'Neill and others. We have a studies department of 70 experts on topics ranging from Latin American regions to global health. So I hope that you will go to our homepage, cfr.org, and submit a question, and we will be happy to answer it. So thank you all again, and thank you, Shannon O'Neill.
My pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this Council on Foreign Relations podcast. For additional audio, video, and transcripts of CFR meetings, as well as expert analysis of international news, please visit us online, cfr.org.